Hi everyone, it's Samila from Menswear by Woman podcast. Welcome to another episode. Today's guest, well, he's actually in Tokyo. He's a very well-known author. He's written quite a lot of books, and one of the most well-known books, I have to say, is How Japan Saved America Style, The Armatero. David Marks is on the podcast, and I'm going to get him on board and talk about menswear. Hi, David. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
It's absolutely amazing to have you on board. Your book, Armatero, I've read, and I'd like to know a bit more how you got to that information and why. Why was Japan saving American style?
Yeah, so the book started really from a couple of things. So first of all, when I was in college, I was in Tokyo for an internship, and I stumbled upon A Bathing Ape, the brand. And this is before it was particularly well-known in the West. And I was just amazed by the intensity of fashion culture in Japan and street fashion in general. And then later, I guess this is almost a decade later, the book Take Ivy, so this 1965 Japanese photo book, I knew from living in Japan, but I started seeing images of it on fashion blogs in the US. And then in 2010, there was the first English reprint of it, which did incredibly well. And there was all this press coverage. And from there, I had met some of the authors of the book in Tokyo. And in hearing their stories, I kind of thought, oh, wow, it would be interesting to do a book that explains why in the world this group of Japanese men decided in 1965 to go over to the Ivy League colleges and make this photo book of the student fashion there. And I ended up pitching it to the publisher of Take Ivy in the US, and they said, oh, why don't you make it a little more broad and kind of be a whole book about Japanese fashion? And so I went to writing it and ended up with a different publisher. But I just saw it as kind of a cultural history of men's fashion in Japan. But of course, publishers need a little bit of tension and drama in the title. So they came back and said, should this be a book called Armatero, How Japan Conquered American Fashion? And I felt conquered was a little heavy-handed, not particularly true, because the number of people wearing Japanese style in, you know, the U.S. is still small. It hasn't actually conquered it. But I did believe that Japan had saved American style in two meanings. The first was Japan saved it in terms of preserving it, archiving it, that they had actually kept all these techniques and the information alive when it was kind of dying in the United States, and then saved as in rescuing, which is when Americans wanted to revive it themselves, they were kind of using the Japanese model, with Take Ivy and a lot of these reproduction brands. So I thought saved was a more accurate and maybe clever title. And so we went with that. But I certainly wasn't thinking at the very beginning about that the kind of value question of did Japan swoop in and save this?
Yeah.
And I sort of thought it would make Americans angry if I wrote a book called, How Japan Saved American Style. But it turned out everyone more or less agreed with the idea, and it was not controversial at all.
With the Japanese do it very well, right? The Ivy style, how they've adapted the American style. Why do you think the Americans have let it go?
So Ivy League style started in the, let's say, 50s and 60s. I mean, it has roots back to, earlier incarnations of kids at Princeton, and there's lots of great books about this. But, let's say, like, classic, what we think about as Ivy League style with Oxford cloth button-down shirts and tweed jackets. So all that really starts with the late 50s and early 60s. And that was an organic style. I mean, there was times in which that style was it turned into a fashion trend or something, but more or less it was just how the kids in these places dressed based off of this aspiration towards British style, more or less.
Yeah.
It's kind of a casual version of trying to dress British among students, and they're wearing it the same way today the kids would wear sweatpants. This was their version of sweatpants just because it was so much more of a formal society. And so one of the problems was that as the United States became more and more casual, especially after the hippies, there was really no need to get dressed up at all. And so, if you're a student, why would you be wearing this version of clothes that I think Americans today consider to be dressing up? And so some of it is that if the reason for its existence was organic and those reasons changed, then no one's going to keep those styles alive. I think obviously Paul Ralph Lauren had the biggest impact in keeping that style alive and keeping it aspirational for lots of people, even outside of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant groups. So Polo really kept it alive too and had that big revival with preppy in the 80s. And there's kind of waves. I mean, I would say Tom Brown probably is most responsible for bringing all of this back in the last 15 to 20 years. But Japan, you know, because it was always a fashion trend, it was always an import, it wasn't organic. It was very easy for these brands to take it very seriously, very reverently, and to build their own brand on the reproduction quality of it. And so, as you know, things went through different trends, there was always still a brand making it, and then the trend would come back once in a while. And so, in some ways, because it was detached from some sort of underlying culture, I think it existed far longer in Japan than it did in the US.
With the with me, right, when I actually look at Ivy style, preppy style, it actually reminds me of jazz a lot.
Sure.
And every time I look at it, it's like I'm sure jazz had a massive influence on it. Because you know, Miles Davis, and they all dressed up the same way as well. How is that, should I say that? Is that correct or is that not correct?
And I would say Ivy League style is, you know, it draws it strength from the fact that it's been in conversation with lots of other styles and lots of different groups. And so, yes, it has this roots in very elite WASP students at Ivy League universities in the early 20th century. But the clothes themselves are being made by Jewish tailors, more or less. And so there's some conversation there. Then when you get to the 50s, Miles Davis and jazz musicians are dressing in Ivy because it's the most cutting edge style at the time and most fashionable. So they're wearing this clothing, and then that's coming back and making the clothes cool among WASP students. And then the same thing happens with Japanese influence on Ivy, and that in some ways inspires Ivy League kids later to get back into Ivy League style. So, you know, the jazz influence, certainly viewed from today, the value of this clothing cannot be detached from the fact that these absolutely iconic musicians were wearing this in some of their most productive and creative period. And so it gives this clothing that is more or less conservative some sort of permanent edge because we can always look back to it. And at the time, certainly the jazz musicians made it a lot cooler, but it's good to remember that the jazz musicians were wearing it in the first place because they thought it was the, you know, most cutting edge style they could wear at the time.
Japan actually adapted the American style, but we've also seen the Italians and the French, they also adapted the Ivy style as well. Should I, because sometimes you could see the crossover. Who, I mean, am I wrong to say the Italians also had the Ivy style as well? Influence of Ivy style.
Yeah, I think those influences are more oblique in the sense that it's hard to chart exactly when they came in and when they came out and what happened. And there's such a strong Italian style and there's such a strong French style that the influence is more subtle. I mean, I think the interchange between the UK and Europe is also one where it's really important to understand how Italian and French style influenced the UK, but it's hard to tell exactly where to draw the line. And I mean, the thing I think about a lot is the Beatles. So the Beatles haircut, which is, you know, one of the most iconic parts of British culture in the 20th century, is absolutely a copy of French students that they, you know, they got that hairstyle when they were in Germany on the continent because the kind of American pompadours they were wearing were suddenly very uncool. So I think why the Japanese influence becomes so particular is because of the distance between Japan and the rest of these places. And so you have this very small opening for these ideas to get inside of Japan. And then because there was not a lot of dialogue between Japan and these places until recently, they kind of grew and became really distinct and, you know, almost like a separate language. And also because the Japanese reverence for the original and the kind of the idea of making sure it stays really close to the original means that a lot of these things that died off elsewhere were still alive when people went to go find them. So France and Italy certainly had took influence and gave influence to American style. It's just that, it's hard to tell. It's hard to draw the lines.
Right. Why do you think the Japanese took the American style, and why didn't they take some other style?
Yeah,
What do
and
you
what's interesting, in the book a little bit fudges this in the sense that there were
Right.
definitely periods of British influence.
Yeah.
So before the war, I would say more or less when someone went to their tailor, they were thinking about a suit as a British
Yeah.
suit. And Savile Row was still kind of setting the
Yeah.
standards. There's a point in the late 60s where people get sick of Ivy and they're wearing Continental and British style. I would say in the 80s, it was a little bit more British than it was American
Yeah.
for a little bit. And then in the early 2000s, before Tom Brown was the same, it was much more Dior, than it was, anything American. But overall, the American style kind of created the industry, and it always bounces back to American style. And I would say casual clothes here are still much more American than they are British. And Ivy has always been way more influential on Japanese society than mod, for example. But in the case of America, it was somewhat the quirk of the first menswear brand, Van Jacket, just happening to build everything off of American style because
Yeah.
they needed something that was young and casual, that looked proper, but still had a little bit of youthfulness and casualness to it. And I think in the minds of the Japanese public at the time, British style was pretty stuffy, very dress up. And then things like Teddy Boys or mods or
Yeah.
skinheads or any of those movements would have been way too subcultural.
Yeah.
So Ivy just hit this sweet spot. And because the entire industry started with that, it kind of got grandfathered in. Japan had been occupied by the United States, and the United States was most certainly in at that time the height of aspiration because it was the richest country. But Britain wasn't so far behind. I don't think it's simply because Japan had been an occupied country that America was particularly influential.
With the Ivy, right, in menswear, it plays a massive role in menswear, Ivy and prep style. Why do you think it plays such a massive role? Because it comes in and it goes out, it comes in, goes out, right? And you can see that in some of the designers' roles as well in menswear. Why do you think we still, bring it back in menswear?
So I think there's a universal quality to it, and that is, at one level, it's because the American experience has become kind of hegemonic. There's that, but let's put that aside for a second. I think there's a
Yeah.
couple things going on. One is that Ivy style was always about rich kids who knew they were rich, not having to show off that they're rich,
Right.
and so. Some ways they're taking this nice clothing and wearing it to the point of total destruction. And there's a nonchalance to it and a casualness that is always cool. It is always cooler to know that you're cool and not look like you're trying than it is to look like you're trying. And
Right.
so that is embedded in Ivy League clothing,
Right.
in that it's these really casual basic fabrics. It's cotton, it's wool, it's not flashy, it's a white button-down shirt with a slight bit of nuance that, hey, this is buttoned down and not some other kind of collar. But more or less, it's just a very casual shirt that somehow you're being fashionable even though you're just wearing a normal shirt. So I think it's the sportiness mixed with the lack of showing off that makes Ivy style have this kind of universal cool to it. And also, because the style is so basic, you can mix and match it with other styles. And so, it's mixed pretty well with streetwear, and it has mixed pretty well with dressing up, and it's mixed well with, Tom Brown has done quite amazing things taking that style and turning it into art as well. And
Yeah.
so, because it's basics, the colors, everything is. It's not like flower print and neons and all sorts of things that are very, clashing with other styles. It can just be incorporated into other things as well. And so all of that just makes it much more of a universal base for other styles rather than it being this, very particular thing that only makes people think about the 60s or the 50s. And the other thing is, every time it comes back, and then you can look at it and say, okay, that's 80s and that's, 2006 era Tom Brown, and that's 1965 or whatever. It has much, or jazz, or this is, J. Press 1920s or whatever. It's much deeper than just saying this is a Peacock 1968 necktie that only really exists in that period.
So, with menswear at the moment, the way it is, what do you think of it now? Because, there's so many elements of menswear at the moment. Do you think we are going towards where Ivy League or preppy? It's slightly going away because the new generation of menswear are coming in and they're not really looking into that kind of style.
I think the really stodgy heritage reproduction from head to toe menswear of 2008 to 2015 or so, I think that period has ended. People are mixing and matching a lot more. When I look to, whether it's someone like Gian De Leon, who's wearing like really bright patterns that are clashing, to even drakes with really bright scarves and neckerchiefs and things like that. I think there's a little bit of moving away from playing it safe. People want a little bit of pop of color and something a little interesting. So we're certainly out of the, it's got to be 100% authentic Ivy head to toe. It's got to be the right loafers, and it's got to be a ribbon belt and all those kind of things. But the Ivy elements are still there for you to mix in. It's not like you see someone with a button-down shirt and say, "Oh God, that's so 2010." And so it's much more about mixing and matching different styles now. But I could certainly also understand, we're getting so out of control with reproducing everything that's ever existed that at some point I can imagine a young group of people saying, like, "We're done with all culture that is, anchored in the past, and we're going to just do completely new things." So, I think we're heading eventually for some sort of pushback against the idea that old things and heritage is the only way to generate value. But it's just at the moment, and I talk about this a lot in my book, Status and Culture. There's something about the internet and culture being so globalized that the past and classic things are one of the very few ways to guarantee high value for something, but I don't think that will last forever. So, yes, at the moment, Ivy League is still there. It's still one of the main pillars of menswear, but I think we're moving away from, having being chained to it.
So, have you been seeing the shows? I suppose you've seen all the menswear shows. That's not,
Not
no,
necessarily. I mean, look, I'm weird in that I'm interested in clothing, and I work with brands, and I write about it, but I've
A
never
follower,
been interested in fashion as
menswear,
an art form, if that makes sense. I mean, not just menswear, but the idea of these luxury brands and the shows and all that is this kind of idiosyncratic expression of a designer's, I don't know, mind or belief or aesthetic or whatever it is, and in kind of an artistic sense. I think the vast majority of people who are interested in fashion find that entertaining. And I'm much more on the side of thinking about clothing as a way to understand society and the social phenomenon of it. And so, there's definitely parts of that story that will trickle down, and I'll eventually see it, but I'm not somebody who is, desperately looking at the collection every time.
Who inspires you then, David? Do you, I mean, as you came into menswear, who was your inspiration? Or did you just fall into menswear?
Well, at the beginning, I grew up in the South in the US, which was still very preppy compared to the North. And it kind of switched where Ivy League style kind of dies in the North, but it still exists, especially on college campuses in the South. And my dad is a professor, so That's kind of the world we knew. And my mom had these upper middle class aspirations, and so she loved to dress us in polo and that she would buy at the local outlets. And so I grew up wearing all this
Oh,
preppy
wow.
clothing that I ended up loathing kind of in the 90s because it was all about, rock and grunge. So I really wanted to get away from that, and I was not interested in clothing until coming to Japan and then seeing streetwear, and suddenly wearing a t-shirt and jeans and sneakers could be fashionable if done it the right way. And so
Yeah.
I got very into streetwear. Nigo from Bathing Ape was absolute style icon for me for many years of that period. When I get to my 20s, was still wearing that and living in New York, but my dad went gray pretty quickly, and I knew I would go gray pretty quickly. I think I was starting to get gray hairs in high school. So I thought by 30 I would be kind of like completely gray, and I did not think streetwear worked with that. These days it's a different world. But at the time I thought I need to start dressing like an adult a little bit faster. And so from there I kind of moved into thinking about, a brand like APC, for this kind of French prep was a little bit closer, because I just still could not go back to American prep. So Thom Browne was a very big deal, and then I saw how the clothing that I grew up with could be cool again. And I think since that time, I've tried to adapt to whatever is happening at the moment, but always in the anchor of the clothing that I'm used to and comfortable with. And I have a closet full of about 30 Oxford cloth shirts in different colors, and that's generally what I wear. But now in Tokyo, there's people just dress incredibly well and do interesting things with material and silhouette. And so there's a brand out of Okayama
Yeah.
called Tsuki, Tuki, and I love their stuff. It's just really, simple silhouettes,
Yeah.
but beautiful materials and great garments based off of old military patterns, but adapting it to today. And then stylist Akio Hasegawa, who I think is not known as much as he should be for how much he's impacted global style, but he's one of the people who really brought in the big silhouette fit from about 2016 that's finally starting to catch on in the US as well. And so that was a big influence too, of just like starting to wear things a little bigger. And I absolutely, stole that or was indoctrinated by him on that. And now there's a bunch of brands here who've really expanded the silhouette, and so Nanamika and adult-oriented robes, and there's a bunch of brands that now make this kind of big fit stuff that's looking great. So these days, still, Japanese, the top of the Japanese style leadership really are ahead from the rest of the world, and they have pretty big influence on the brands, and the
Yeah.
brands adapt to whatever they're doing, and there's great stuff here.
How important is culture in menswear?
I would say menswear is always going to be much more about clothing than fashion.
Right.
And these words are kind of arbitrary and meaningless, so I'll just define them, which is, fashion is very much about some sort of fleeting trend.
Right.
And clothing tends to be, at least in our imagination, anchored to some sort of lifestyle.
Yeah.
And so, there is this kind of global taboo, and you could probably write an entire book about it, about why men are not supposed to be participating in fashion as fashion. And so it's really important that when men buy things, that they always have some sort of alibi to point to say, well, I'm a skater and this is a skateboarding brand and therefore I'm wearing it, or this boot is made with the
Yeah.
best leather with this really incredible stitch down construction or
Yeah,
whatever it
yeah.
is. But there needs to be something that makes everybody else know that, oh, they're not interested in fashion, they're just interested in having great clothing that looks good. And so, culture is one of the main anchors for those alibis of why your clothing is not fashion. So culture matters, and culture also is just like a very, very broad term, we use it in different ways. But I think what you're really asking is, clothing that connects to music, that connects to film, that connects to sports, that
Yeah.
connects to the way people live, rather than just this arbitrary set of new designs that you have to wear because the fashion magazines tell you.
Because one thing is right, David, but what you've just hit the note there. Because I always think menswear is always about lifestyle and clothing. It's not really fashion to me, because the details in clothing, the silhouettes and the texture of the fabric, it to me, menswear is totally different from fashion, if you think about it. It's something that I've always believed in, because I don't look at like women's wear is fashion, and men's wear isn't fashion. Does that make sense, or am I talking load of rubbish in
No,
a
I
sense?
mean, I'm slightly more cynical in the sense that menswear sells people fashion with the idea that it's not fashion, and these lines are all arbitrary in our heads. But that is the reason menswear has exploded since 2005, is that it found a way to speak to men who would never get interested in fashion. So you are, what you're saying is absolutely true, which is that
Thank you.
there's an appeal there of you can dress well without being somebody who looks like a who has no opinions of their own, is just following the market. And that was a big deal. I mean, I think for a long time the reason I was interested in streetwear is because it had connections to musicians that I liked. And so, A Bathing Ape was very connected with a bunch of musicians that I liked, and kind of indie music in general. And so that made sense. So it's like, well, if I like this kind of music, then this makes sense that I would dress this way. That made sense to me, even, growing up on grunge or something, is wearing, Dinosaur Jr. t-shirt because I like the band. For a long time, I think guys had a problem saying, I don't want to dress in a way that makes me look vain. And so if some menswear is, its power is that it's been able to expand by saying, this isn't about the vagaries of the market or vanities. It's just about great clothing that connects to some part of your life that is real and authentic, or even, hey, your grandfather used to look like this, and so you feel like you're just getting back to that heritage. So no, I mean, that's the way menswear is sold, and that's the success of it. And without culture, it can do well for a blip, but then it goes away. And I also in Status and Culture talk about virality. Viral culture isn't culture. It just it pops up, it entertains you for a second, it disappears. And so, the worst thing a brand could do is be viral. A brand should connect with some sort of deeper meaning, a deeper community. And so, that's why menswear works, is because brands don't pop up at all unless they have that value proposition that goes beyond just this is hot for a moment.
So that's the next book then, David.
Well, the book, so I'm writing my third book, which is, we announced 2 weeks ago. So I'm writing a cultural history of the 21st century, and trying to do a little bit more of the narrative storytelling that I did in Ambotura, but tackle some of the big ideas of status and culture. So yeah, I'm looking, one of the big things I'm looking at is that evolution of streetwear, where it goes from being more or less a white subculture of the US and UK, with some Japanese, like, huge expansion in Japan, but subcultural in terms of skateboarding, surfing, all of that, to then becoming central to Black American culture through Pharrell and Kanye. And then expanding out to now being, with Virgil and then Pharrell at Louis Vuitton, just central to the luxury industry. And there really is no luxury industry that can be separated from streetwear today. So that journey, I think, is a huge part of the 21st century. And because I've written about menswear, it seems like obvious I'm going to focus on that. And I don't know if another person writing about a cultural history of the 21st century would put as much emphasis on it, but it's a huge part of it. So, I mean, I think that transformation and how something like Supreme goes from a store that was always cool, but in even 2001, 2002, you could just walk right into the store on Lafayette and get a t-shirt, and it would be, I don't know, $25, to being this place where people are lining up and, the resellers are, charging three times the price. Like, all of that whole phenomenon, that expansion is a huge part of culture and how it changed.
It's true because luxury fashion has become very street fashion as well, right? Because street fashion is luxury, isn't it? Because all the luxury houses are doing this now. Graffiti, I remember when I was at St. Martin's, and I used to love graffiti work and all that stuff, and I used to put that in my design, and they were always like, oh, graffiti wasn't. It shouldn't be on clothing, and it's like, look at it now. I mean, just a few years back, graffiti work was on clothing, and it's a sign of streetwear, right? Streetwear has this massive, massive culture in menswear. To me, I mean, streetwear to me, like the British streetwear would be like Sergio Tacchini, Adidas, Nike, all of these guys. When I was growing up, I was seeing all of this. Like my brother was wearing all of this, like the hip hop kind of look. And I've got pictures of my brother and his mates wearing all of this stuff. And it played a huge part in menswear, though I didn't know I was going into menswear at that time because I was quite very young. But all of this, it still is a huge part of menswear. You can't, and it's really, it's not weird, but I don't know what the word I'm looking for. But you see, all the luxury houses are doing this as well now. They're adapting streetwear into their luxury houses. Why do you think that is
Yeah,
now at the
absolutely.
moment? Why do you think that is?
There's a very specific reason, which is if you think about one third of the luxury consumer today is from China, and that's going to grow to, let's say, 40%, from 30 to 40%. So that's your growth. These are all publicly traded companies. They have to move in a certain direction. And people who grew up in China, the first major experience with fashion that they had was bathing ape going to Hong Kong in 1999. And from there, streetwear really explodes. Local people like Edison Chen get really deep into the Japanese streetwear world. Supreme gets huge. And so you have this major streetwear movement that, I mean, it's still just huge across Greater China. And then as they get older and have more money, and their parents have more money for them to spend, they're looking at the luxury brands. The luxury brands have this kind of universal communication value compared to anything local. But there, people in China are not, they don't have the imaginary luxury lifestyle of what these brands are founded on, which is red carpet, gala events and balls and things like that. And so people want to wear this stuff in their daily lives and on the streets. And so you've got to adapt the clothing to work towards your main growth customer group. And so whether this is an organic change or an intentional one, I can't tell you. I can't speak for the brands themselves, but rationally and logically, if that's going to be your business model to always grow, to make clothing that can actually be worn in real life and fits people's lifestyles, what's going to be more street? And then the second is street, the street marketing, the way of selling clothes with scarcity and drops and collaborations. All of that worked perfectly with the industry because they could, find ways to generate hype on a weekly or monthly basis through these techniques. And so, obviously Nike and Adidas all got into that, and then the luxury brands too. So the whole industry kind of moved in the streetwear direction. But also, I think there's something specific about streetwear being at the heart of the same way that Japan's menswear world starts with Ivy League fashion, the China street China men's fashion world, and even women's, really starts with the streetwear brands. So it's just core to the DNA of that customer.
So, David, about your menswear, what are you, how do you, I suppose you dress, as you said, like the ivy wear. Is that something that you are going to carry on dressing that way? Or do you change into other different?
I certainly change, and I think it's important, and some of it's natural, just that every human gets bored, and when you look at things too much, you start saying, okay, enough of that. So If I were to have to wear a button-down shirt and a navy blazer and a regimental tie every day, I would get pretty bored of that pretty quickly. So I think my thing is just to have some sort of core and some principles, and then adapt to whatever, is going on at the moment, and to try things out, to like once a year buy a couple pieces that are pushing me a little bit, or to try new combinations of what I have that push it a little bit. I try to also make sure that all my clothing that I own gets not, gets reused. So I'm always patching up holes and putting elbow patches on sweaters and things like that. So I try to use what I have, and I just try to mix it in new ways sometimes. And it could be even just I've had this turtleneck that I never wore for a long time because I hated turtlenecks. I think it's my brother's. I think I have a photo of him wearing it that I'm looking at right now. And I inherited it, and then it was just in a closet for a long time. I think throughout college, I owned it and wore it like once. But now it's like I'm using the turtleneck, and so I'll mix it and match it with some things because turtlenecks are cool, or whatever it is. So, I try to just have enough repertoire that I can kind of mix and match to fit with whatever's going on. That's still me, and I'm still always going to choose cotton and wool over polyester and plasticky nylon things. I'm
Of course.
always gonna enjoy a nice tweed if I can get away with it, but it's just too hot these days. It just doesn't get cold enough to really justify buying a lot more tweed. And if I'm gonna buy a technical fabric, the cut of the garment should be traditional or whatever. I have some, basic principles, and try not to go away from them. And I do think you should be able to look at me and get a general sense of something about me. And I do really like reading old books and writing, overthinking things. And so, to dress tweed or a button-down shirt or Oxford, I mean, all of those are reflective of universities and have the symbolism of that. And so that's kind of core to my identity and my background, and I'm not going to lose that part. But today I'm wearing a big human-made fleece over a Uniqlo Lifewear hoodie somebody gave me that's on top of a striped shirt with some old corduroys that I got used. They're like used polo corduroys I got in Japan that now totally gotten frayed and messed up. So I don't know. To me, it's just about like having the core and making small adjustments.
If someone, do you hear about any of the younger generation going into Ivy? Wearing Ivy?
I mean, in Tokyo, it's hard because there's a scene and there's young people who show up in that scene. So it's hard to extrapolate it out and say, okay, these are normal young people. I think they're very specific. But you see bits of it around. I mean, I wouldn't say I see young people dressing in head to toe, like navy blazer style, navy blazer plus khaki frat boy style or something. But you see elements of it once in a while.
And what the last question, and this question might start a bit of a argument throughout the whole menswear. Who's the stylish menswear? Which country has the most stylish menswear? The best menswear, in your view?
I mean, it's really hard not to say Japan, and just in terms of quantity, I think Japan wins in terms of still the number of stylish men and the depth of knowledge and the incredible quantity of great brands and great product that's at your fingertips. And still the fact that you could just make things in Japan means that these brands can do quite incredible things. So it really doesn't matter which side of the menswear spectrum you're on. That could be ultra luxury, that could be complete streetwear, athletic. There is just a surplus of things here. And if you're into vintage, if you go to Koenji, there's, let's say, I don't know, 60 to 100 vintage stores there, and that's only one of the vintage neighborhoods in Tokyo. And so again, the quantity, it's not even a contest. I would say the UK to me has always had an allure in that there's something authentic about the way people dress in the UK to me. I was into streetwear, let's say late 90s, and Bathing Ape was basically unavailable anywhere except for Japan and then in the UK. And there was a lot of guys who were wearing wearing selvedge denim and Japanese streetwear really well from the UK. So I would say that's probably number two. And then, the US, there's a group of guys in New York that dress well, and that's pretty much it. I mean, I think the thing that was cool about the US for a while is that organically you just had groups of people like these university students who weren't trying but somehow had this great nonchalant look, and I don't think that really exists anymore. So, I mean, but I was just in Milan, and like it's great being in Milan because everybody dresses up and dresses great. So it's I don't know. I just don't, definitely don't see it as some sort of global competition. I think there's a menswear scene that goes from Milan to Paris to London to New York and a little bit of LA and definitely Tokyo, and now Shanghai and Seoul are kind of showing up in that. And these places are unified and cool, and there's great guys dressing up in all of those places, and there's a commonality to how they're dressing in all those places, and there's a world in which everybody is looking at each other, and when one person goes from one place to another, that they reach out to each other and hang out, and I don't know. So it's that part was interesting to me, the cosmopolitan nature of it.
This is the very last question. I keep saying this to every
Sure.
guest. What is the l worst thing about menswear that you don't like?
I guess I mean it's hard to answer this question without somebody feeling attacked, so I'm going to be careful, but I think it's not menswear as much as hashtag menswear. I think the when menswear becomes this thing you're showing off online, is showing fit pics and stuff like that. I think that to me is, it's not just that I don't necessarily like it, but I think it's dangerous in that it does really make it superficial and it doesn't make it feel like it's organic and from a community. And this isn't specific to menswear. I think this is a problem with the internet in general, which is the cultural things are all arbitrary in the sense that human beings are not programmed at birth to find any of these things more attractive than other things. It is this whole network of meaning that we are inheriting that makes us think a polo shirt is cool or a button-down shirt is cool. And all of those things came out of very specific communities. And so it's important, I think, to live in a world where you actually wear these things around people who wear these things, and that the menswear itself doesn't become fetishized and become your personality. So you should have a personality that is reflected in menswear. Menswear should not be your personality, if that makes sense. So I think my issue with menswear is not menswear. It's just it's when people get so into it that that's all they talk about and all they think about, rather than realizing the value of all these things came out of a group of people who are doing other things with their lives and they happen to be wearing cool clothes.
And on that note, David, I'd just like to say thank you so much for coming on to Menswear by a Woman podcast. It's been an absolute honor and amazing to have you on board. I think the books that you've written, especially the Armatero, it's an amazing book. So everyone, if you're into menswear, you have to read this book because it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much, David, for coming on.
Thank you for having me on, and thanks to anyone who's already read the book. I'm always shocked that it has, 8 years after publishing it, it's still out there and being read, which is really exciting. But thanks to everyone.